Welcome to What is Going Om, for new thought from the edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. Near-death experiences are not a new phenomenon. Plato claimed that Socrates had had one, and so did Pliny the Elder. According to a report published a few years back, an estimated 200,000 Americans have reported experiencing an NDE. And numerous research studies have been conducted and published on this experience. Tonight we're going to be talking about near-death experiences that occur in early childhood and the lifelong impact this has on the lives of those children. My guest is internationally respected researcher and leading authority on NDEs, PMH, Atwater, who's dedicated the past 40 plus years to researching, lecturing, compiling data and interviewing over 5,000 adults and children. PMH Atwater, welcome back to the show.
Oh, I'm just so glad to be here. This is good.
I know. And you've had so many on-air conversations with me over the years. I can't believe that anybody doesn't know who you are. But just in case, I'm just going to say a little bit about you. A three-time near-death experiencer. You're the author Within 3 months,
yes. Three near-death experiences in 3 months.
Yeah, is that a bit greedy?
I look back at it and I call it the heavenly sledgehammer effect.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And as a result of that, you're the author of 18 groundbreaking books on NDEs, spiritual experiences, transformations of consciousness, reality shifts, future memory, etc. You've lectured twice at the United Nations, appeared on numerous TV and radio talk shows, and received prestigious awards for your research, as well as having been cited in the Lancet Medical Journal. So, your latest book, The Forever Angels, Near-Death Experiences in Childhood and Their Lifelong Impact. What were you looking for when you started focusing your research on early childhood NDE experiences?
Well, actually, I was rather angry. And I was angry because I had already done this. The book is The New Children and Near-Death Experiences. And I found a number of anomalies. And you know, I talked to all kinds of people trying to get somebody else to go in there and find out what's going on here. Did I see right or not? Couldn't get anybody interested. So I finally decided, okay, enough of this. I'll do it myself. So I started out again about 3-4 years ago and started researching children. Although this time I went after birth to up to the age of 5. So I'm going after the little bitty ones. Most of them had no before. So they have nothing they can compare anything with, like an older child or an adult can. Fortunately, in my first book, most of the people who helped me with that book or who volunteered were about 7 and under. I was going after birth to the age of 15, but you know, I couldn't get the teenagers or the tweens to cooperate. So from 7 and under, and most of those were actually from 6 and under. So I could take that research where I was dealing with the young ones while they were still young, up to maybe the early 20s. In other words, forward-looking. And this time, I went after the mature group, people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, who could verify having had a near-death experience between birth and the age of 5. And I asked them one question. What was it like for you to have such an experience at such a young age? Yeah, did it have any effect on your life? If it did, what? So in essence, I was asking for essays. And boy, was I ever flooded. The turnout was just remarkable. Just bowed me over. And you know, some of the people were kind of angry. And they were angry because they lived in poverty. And they said, no researcher goes after us and wants to know what we went through. Well, I did. I listened to them. One woman saved all. Can you imagine this, Sandra? One woman saved all of her pennies, literally pennies, until she had enough to pay for postage and an envelope. And then she sent me her essays. Her essay. Most of the essays were so tear-stained, I could hardly read them. One fellow, had just retired. So he was in his late 60s. And he could never talk to anybody about anything or why he was different, or he couldn't understand any of this kind of stuff. And, you know, when he finally had an opportunity, somebody wanted to hear from him. His essay was 50 pages long, complete with family photos.
I can imagine.
It's just unbelievable.
After all the research you'd done already, was this a surprise to you? I mean, what did you learn that was different?
Oh, it was a complete surprise. In fact, the research I did turns around what we think we know about near-death experiences. This is a challenge to everyone, not just me. So I'm saying to everyone, get the book, The Forever Angels. I've got sections in that book for health caregivers, therapists, for the people themselves, markers, cases in history. And then I spend a lot of time with the people themselves. Some drew pictures, told us their stories, and then I went after, of course, the numbers and the research, and it's like nothing else I've ever come across.
Well, what was so different then? What did it turn on its head?
Well, you know, we've got to keep in mind here, these, for the most part, are people who had no before. So we're talking about birthers. We're talking about birth. We're talking about ages 1, 2, 3, toddlers. So it's a whole different view of what life was like coming in. About 1/3 of them could remember their birth and remember it clearly. Many of those could remember being in the womb and remember it clearly. I had two who were there when they were conceived. They saw it happen, the position of the parents, all this kind of stuff, drew a picture about it. And when they were old enough, told their parents about, showed the picture, much to the embarrassment of the parents, because they were absolutely correct. Can you imagine that? They're absolutely correct. So we're looking, what I found overall, these youngsters coming in, they're coming in from a light-filled world. There were a few, and there are stories and drawings in the book, who could, you know, reincarnation, could remember their past lives, this kind of thing, but most of them could not. And I think we all have to take a pause here and take a look at this. Most of them could not. In fact, they didn't even relate to anything like reincarnation or past lives. What they talked about was the life stream. So I've got a lot of people talking about the life continuum, the life stream, that river of consciousness that we all go back to and then visit, you know, from time to time. And their conception, most of them, of life is that life is over there. And that river goes along and we'll take a dip. That's what we call a life here on planet Earth or wherever. Then we go back and we go on, and then maybe take another dip, maybe not. So they look at life in the body different than most near-death experiencers do, and certainly different from most of us do. Mm. So it's an entirely different way of looking at things. And when they talk about their families, they don't relate to their families. If you had a child who had a near-death experience between birth and the age of 5, they do not think like anybody else in the family. In fact, very often they don't fit the family because they're so different. They don't think like anybody else in school. They don't relate to school. For the most part, these kids are coming in, or these people, these souls, however you want to address them, are coming in, and they're smarter, most of them, than the average child or baby. Most of them are abstracting by the first grade. So we can certainly go into that as we go along. One of the things that I really want to emphasize here is these kids, you know, when you're talking about children, the average adult takes 7 to 10 years to integrate their near-death experience. Now, a lot of them will say they did it quicker, but if you're around them, if you talk to them, if you study them, you find out, nope, they're not integrated yet. So the average adult, 7 to 10 years. The average child, any child, especially the young ones, up to about the age of 7 and 8, the average child takes 20 to 40 years to integrate their near-death experience, and that's because a child does not integrate. They compensate. Their desire, their urge, is to fit in. You know, fit into the family. They don't integrate. They compensate.
One of the things that struck me in your book, you said that you noted that the child who returns from a near-death experience is not the same child as before, but is a remodeled, rewired, reconfigured, refined version of the original. And a lot of parents bear this out. But isn't that also true of adult experiences? Don't they come back different?
Yes, and certainly I did.
Yeah.
I'm an example of that. But the children, these little bitty ones, even more. And they come back different in a different way. That's what really surprised me, is they're coming back in a different way. And they tend to follow a kind of pattern. And so we're talking now about children. We're not talking about adults. So let's put adults over on a corner somewhere in our mind. And let's blank out our mind and focus more on little bitty kids. The average child experiencer, and especially birth to the age of 5, most of them are abstracting by the first grade. Now, let me give you an example of that. This is a boy in Georgia, the state of Georgia, a little bit north of Atlanta. And he's in the first grade. He's not quite 6. Drowns about halfway through the school year. Had to take him out of school, of course, and keep him out until, you know, he's well enough to go back. So think in your mind here. What is the average child reading in the first grade? I don't know what it is in England, but in the United States, it's See, Spot, Run.
Yeah.
Dick and Jane. This boy comes back reading Greek mythology and understands it, and goes up to his teacher and says, why was the book Robinson Crusoe ever written? Well, of course, the teacher's stunned. She had to pull him out of the class. But it's that kind of thing. It's just like, whoa!
You have a lot of, in one of your chapters on historical experiences, you cite a lot of well-known people who were very precocious and did amazing things at young ages, and had some of them even had several near-death experiences, like Benedict Cumberbatch. I never knew that about him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just read his book. He'll tell you all about it.
Wow.
He's a typical near-death experiencer, child near-death experiencer. Absolutely typical. Look at the way he thinks. Absolutely typical.
And
you know, I had a guy call me, about a month or two by now. He was 49 years old. He was a cop in New York City, so he's a New York City cop, hardened, you know, New York City cop. He was crying, and he just read my book. And he said, now I understand myself.
Yeah.
I never understood myself before. I now understand why I'm the way I am. Mm. I was just absolutely crying. New York City cop, 49 years old. Yeah. You know, just really got me.
There's one piece. You present data to support your contention that these children have experienced structural, chemical, and functional changes in the brain. What about that experience is, I mean, how does that happen? If they're having this experience, what is actually happening?
Look at it this way. You know, I can't say how because I'm not a scientist or a medical physician, but I can't, I'm an analytical observer. So I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at it very carefully, and I'm saying to myself, isn't this interesting? That when a child, when the beginnings in the brain, when the brain is just being laid down with thought patterns, nervous patterns, nerves, all this kind of circuitry is just being laid in, they're being hit by the power punch of a near-death experience. And by the way, the near-death experience is a power punch. So many of us, of course, come back with electrical sensitivity. You bet it's a power punch. So just imagine that kind of power hitting a little bitty baby or a toddler when those original patterns in the brain are just being laid down. Of course it changes them. And it changes them in major, big ways. A lot of them have stenesthesia. In fact, that's very common. Stenesthesia is in the limbic system in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
It's a multiple or, a different kind of sensing. I can give you an example in my own life. I was born that way. No, I'm not a near-death experiencer, but I was born that way. I was born with stenesthesia. So I was the only kid in the first grade who could smell color, see music, and hear numbers. Of course, that didn't go over very well. I spent most of the first grade on a tall stool in front of the class having to wear a dunce cap on my head that said I was a liar. And the principal of the school did everything he could to get me kicked out of school. And my mother would come in and fight him. Thank God for my mother that she would do that. She believed I was a liar too, but she wanted me to be kept in the first grade. At the end of the first grade, I was so angry. Just so angry. That I decided I was never going to be an adult when I grew up because all adults are stupid. Mm. And of course, you know, I'm kind of still that way. But, you know, when you're, you know, more, even adults, because, you know, synesthesia is also true with adults. An example, when an adult goes to buy a painting or a picture for their bedroom or their living room, they'll go for how the picture sounds, not just how it looked. And that's synesthesia.
Yeah, yeah. There are other things that happen, like suddenly developing allergies to things and being more sensitive to all kinds of things in the environment. In fact, you say that there are several patterns of after effects, physiological, psychological, emotional, health.
Well, you know, we're looking at sort of a different breed of cat, if you will. Because we, you know, one of the things that really captured me about these early experiencers, and I noted this is almost all of them. When they come in as a little bitty baby, they are tracking where their parents are. Brothers and sisters, moms and dads, whatever. They are taking out-of-body trips because that's normal and natural for them. And they will track where dad is going, when he comes back, what mom is doing. Let's say she's in the kitchen, they'll buzz around her head and find out what she's doing. Brothers and sisters, same thing. So they're keeping track of what's going on in the family. They want to know what's going on. And this continues as they get older. Because they are so smart and certainly very, very, very psychic and intuitive, they just know things and pick up things right away, which is not to their best. Because, you know, they get bullied a lot in school. Teachers can't really handle them too well. They don't understand where they're coming from. We've got this one individual who got her math all comes in circles, and she's dancing in the ethers, and that's how she does her math. There's a picture of it in the book, by the way. She drew an incredible picture of it. And, of course, that's synesthesia. but she was always getting the right answer in school, even to really tough, hard questions, to the point that her teacher came over to her and thought she was a genius. And she had invited this expert to come with her and talk to the kid. Well, this scared the child. So she stopped talking, and they were not able to verify her math because they scared her.
Yeah, life must be very painful for them and very strange. I'm going to go to break now, PMH. We'll be back in a few moments and we'll continue then. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with internationally renowned near-death researcher, pioneering author and authority on NDEs and their after effects on adults and children. And we're talking about her groundbreaking study of the lifelong effects of near-death experiences in the newly born, babies, toddlers and children up to the age of 5. We'll be back with more from PMH Atwater after the break.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio. IOM FM.
19, brought to you by CDC and the Ad Council.
With so much loss, you may feel like you can't handle it all. Meditation or other spiritual practices can help you feel more grounded and better able to cope.
Find more self-care and coping tips at coping-19.org.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Vox Novus, the new voice. Vox Novus, the new dimension. Vox Novus, thought and movement leaders who will share from their experience and offer tools to help us navigate our rapidly changing world. My name is Victor Furman. Join me every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio for Vox Novus, the new voice.
Mental health. Most people think it means mental illness. Most people are wrong. Mental health doesn't apply to just some of us. It applies to everyone. We're all susceptible to anxiety and depression. They're human conditions, and no person should ever feel embarrassed, ashamed, or be discriminated against for being human. Cracked the Podcast strips away the shame, fear, and stigma by expanding the conversation into areas less often visited. From brain and body chemistry, hormones, food, nutrition, trauma, and the microbiome, to pharmaceutical drugs, psychedelic substances, meditation, visionary experiences, and spiritual awakenings. Cracked, the Podcast, will explore them all, including the notion that, for many, breakdown can be the beginning of breakthrough. For in the words of singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen, there is a crack in everything. It's where the light gets in. Cracked, the Podcast, slaying the dragons of mental health. Join co-hosts Sandy Sedgbeer and Rebecca Shaper on the first and third Thursday of every month at 12 noon Eastern Time.
Came across someone struggling with hunger. How would you recognize them?
By their clothes.
Their age.
The way they speak.
Hunger can be hard to recognize. Learn why at IamHungerInAmerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America, 200 Food Banks Strong, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. PMH Atwater, you dedicated the Forever Angels to Tracy Cohen. Tell us why.
Please repeat that.
Tracy Cohen, you dedicated your book, The Forever Angels, to Tracy.
Oh, yeah.
Who had a near-death experience in utero. Tell us about that experience and why you dedicated this
book
to her.
She had her near-death experience in the womb as she was trying to be born while her mother was trying to commit suicide.
My God.
So you've got those three critical things happen. And she really was very supportive of this book. She had read some of the material, and it really helped her a lot to understand what her life was like. And so I dedicated it to her. I mean, Tracy was quite a lady. She's not with us anymore. She just slipped and disappeared one day. Everybody thinks that she loved to run around the coast. She lived on the coast, New England coast, and loved to every morning, you know, being around the rocks and the ocean. And we all think she probably slipped and was claimed by the ocean.
You said that she remembered the episode of her mother.
Oh, she remembered every bit of it.
Everything. That must have been awful.
Clearly.
How did she cope with that?
Clearly. And she had a tough time coping with it, as all of them do. And I want to talk about a couple of things here, a couple of cases where I hope everybody listening kind of clicks into this. I had one case. This is a case of Penny, and hers is in the womb, and she knew the moment her mother was going to smoke. Her mother was a smoker, and whenever her mother would light up and smoke, Penny said she would get high, and she didn't like it. And she just sort of would grit and do everything she could to kind of hold herself in whenever her mother would do that. She didn't like her mother smoking. And I think this is a clear message to any woman out there who smokes or drinks that does directly affect the child in the womb. I don't care what your doctor's telling you. It does directly affect you. Now, the other case I want to talk about briefly is Alma. Alma was raped about 2 years old by a family friend. The friend would come visit the family, and Alma's door would be to her bedroom would be closed, so he'd go inside, close it again. Nobody in the family knew what he was doing. And he would get on top of her in the bed and almost suffocate her because he was so much bigger than she was, and rape her. Of course, you can imagine the pain and all of this other kind of stuff. But what I want you all to focus on is, of course, she left her body. So she's viewing all of this from the ceiling looking down. Please, everybody, get over your propensity to call this an out-of-body experience. This is a defense mechanism. All children, when they have high fevers or threatened or ill, will leave their body. They do that to save themselves, to save the soul. And so they can view the scene looking down. That's a defense mechanism. They are doing that to save the most precious part of them, the I am, if you're a near-deather, or if you're into spirituality, you call it the I am. They're saving the I am, the soul, the spirit, whatever you want to call it. But that, I think, is very important, especially for your psychologist to know that this is not just an out-of-body experience. It is a defense mechanism.
You relate the story of one woman who was brought up in what was basically a satanic cult. And she said
Judy.
Over time, she could actually have compassion. You know, she would be out of her body and she would have compassion for these people.
You know, I'm glad you pointed out, Judy. She had 17 near-death experiences from 6 weeks of age until almost between 9 and 10 years old. She had 17 of them. She was one of three I came across where the only reason the mom and dad ever had her, ever wanted her, is because they wanted a baby to sacrifice on Satan's altar. These were Satanists. And what she went through is just horrifying. And, of course, she went through a long period of you know, try to find herself, and went through a lot of therapy, but she said, you know, most of these people say that yoga and psychics are better than going to a psychologist. They get more out of it. And she got a lot out of yoga, became a yoga teacher, and became a healer. And in looking back, I don't know if I can find real quickly here what she said. If I can put my finger on it real. Yes, here it is. All my experiences in this life, whether they appeared to be dark or light, are expressions of love, experiences of searching for love. I came into this life with a purpose. This was not known to me until much later in my life, or I would not have been able to truly know the experience as they were in the moment. What I know today has brought everything full circle. Mm. I mean, can you imagine that from this woman?
Yeah.
What
and
she
she's, you know, married, happily married. Happy children and grandchildren, and has moved beyond all of that, which is just astonishing. Astonishing. Just, you know, when you talk to people that are older who had these experiences when they were young, do they think that they were negative or positive?
Well, that's a big one. It's really a catch-22. When I was asking about that, 34% were positive about their very, very little tiny, when they were very little having a near-death experience. 61% were negative. 61% were negative. Let me just quickly put that in context. 90% could not bond with their parents. Now, this is a major study. This is 397 people. This is a major study. 90% of 397 people could not bond with their parents. That doesn't mean they didn't love them. That means they couldn't bond with them. They were still part of this light-filled world. They didn't bond at all. When we're looking at changes afterward, aware of the future, 61%. Here, turn to drug use, 46%. Turn to alcohol, 45%. Very successful career in life. Really, so some of them became millionaires, 74%. Now, remember that figure, 74%. Remember that. 84% come back empathic, highly intelligent, 75%. For those who took the standard IQ test when they were old enough in school, took the standard IQ test, I've got right around 48%. Yeah, 48%. In the standard IQ test, we're scoring between 150 to 160 with no genetic markers to account for it. None. If they had their experience between birth and 15 months, especially if they had a dark light experience instead of a bright light experience, their IQ began at 180.
Wow.
180. 180. Just imagine that. Okay, so I'm talking here about these incredible people who are changed in remarkable ways, even those that weren't changed that much, like the cop in New York, were still changed. And I said, remember that 74%. 74% had suicide ideation throughout their life.
Wow, same percentage.
We same percentage. Highly successful, suicide ideation, same figure.
What drove them to be highly successful, do you think?
They're coming into this world, most of them, very intelligent people, lots of energy, most of them.
Mm.
Coming in as inventors, most of them. Your child experiencer, most of these do not come in wanting to be psychics or mediums, like a lot of adult experiencers do, or wanting to become teachers or healers or ministers like a lot of adult experiencers do. No, they're the opposite. They want to get into science. They want to get into business. They want to get into inventions. They want to know what makes this world work. They want to understand that, so that they're getting into science, a lot of them. So, yeah. In fact, one of them in my research bays was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Hmm. I mean, these are incredible people. But the suicide ideation, we want to focus on what that is. And I'm telling you, we don't understand how children consider and picture suicide. For the average child, they were in this loving, wonderful, bright world when they were not breathing. Now, they're no longer in that world, but they're breathing. So for the average child, aha! The way to get back to that wonderful world is to stop my breathing. They do not think of it as bad. They do not think of it as hurting anybody. They do not think of it as a nightmare of any kind. To a child, it's perfectly logical.
Well,
That's why I'm saying to the parents, teach them visualization techniques. They can get back and go back and forth and back and forth, and they don't have to harm themselves. That's all it takes. Simple, that's all it takes, and we don't think of that.
If many of them, most of them, have these memories of heaven or whatever one wants to call it, and a place of being very happy and very loved, do any of them say why they came here, why they incarnated? You know, what was the motivation for that?
All I can do is pass along what most of them told me. Most of them said it was time. What they mean by that, I don't know. It was just said, you know, it was time for them to take a dip.
Huh.
Some of them said they got pushed in. They didn't want to come in. They got pushed. And some just slipped in. There's a few, remember, that I said would talk about reincarnation. It was their time to take this. So they would have this relationship with a mom or a dad or whatever. But most of them said, you know, it was just time for them to come in. And they didn't explain that, because they didn't understand that themselves. It was just simply time to come in, so they came.
Mm. Oh, I want to talk about the new kids and these children who are having NDE experiences. There seem to be some similarities, you've pointed out, in certain characteristics and abilities. Has there been an increase? Do we know if there's been an increase in the number of children who have had near-death experiences at a very early age, since many of these new kids have been coming in? Is there a correlation there?
Well, kind of, sort of, but no. what I'm seeing with the new kids, and you want to get my book, Children of the Fifth World, is that the human race, I believe, is evolving. Now, most of your scientists say, no. We're the same, and I'm saying you're crazy. We're not the same. I believe, and I know, and I've been able to show in that book, that the human race as a race is changing. And so that's these new kids that are coming in. They are smarter than the children before. They have some very different traits. And so I would urge anyone to get a hold of that book and take a look at that. The reason I did that research of the new kids is because some of them, and in fact really most of them, it seemed to me like they were a lot like near-death kids. Because they're smarter, you know, they think different. So I wanted to investigate that. And, I had to dig deep and take a good look and see, wait a minute here. We've got something absolutely absolutely unique that is happening here with these new kids. So at some time, maybe in the future, we can take a look at that, and I can get all my notes out and get really specific here. Because when we're talking about the new kids, we're also talking about the changing times, changing weather, changing governments. And they fit right into that.
But what about the kids in this particular book, the ones that have had those experiences? How do you see, you know, their place in this changing world?
They challenge us. They force us to take another look. One of the things that absolutely thrills me about these kids is they look at everything differently than anybody else. So that's good. We always need that unique mind. But they're really showing us that what we don't pay much attention to, we ought to. And that is what makes everything tick. But they, because they're coming in and they're looking at what makes families work, what makes relationships work, what makes clocks work, what makes science work. They want to know what and why. And they do it with a dedication that is just remarkable. And we need that. We need people willing to tear things up and take another look at what we think everything works. And they're finding out, no, that's not the way everything works.
Well, you said that they want to know how relationships work. How do these kids who've had early childhood near-death experiences navigate the world as they grow? I mean, if they're not, they love their parents, but they're not bonded to them. How do they manage with relationships when, you know, when it's time to, when they reach adulthood or their teenage years?
Well, you know, some of them go through a lot of problems, as you might guess. Some of them get into drugs, some of them get into alcohol because they can't figure it out. Those that work out the best are those that get into business. It's remarkable. They get into business or training and teaching.
Do they find it easy to talk about, or do they keep it secret?
Well, they don't recognize it. They don't recognize. Let me give you another example. This is a stewardess. I guess you'd call it a stewardess that I met in Toronto at the airport in Toronto, and she was just bubbling along, and she was talking about how she's not like anybody else in her family, and she just got the registration. They just accepted her into marine school. She wants to study marine things, you know, oceans and this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. She was just accepted. She went so high. She was 100% enthusiastic. And then she said, I'm not like anybody else in the family. Nobody else in the family understands me. And I don't fit my family, so I'm just going to get more into marine biology. And that was her solution. And that's the way a lot of them are. They want to get involved with healing or helping or lifting or making new.
So what are your conclusions from this research? I mean, what is it that we most need to know about this?
Well, I think what we most need to know about ourselves is that we are multidimensional. All of us are. I don't care how old you are. We're all multidimensional. We are all a soul. And that soul is what drives and energizes this body we wear. And it is what tends to challenge this brain we think we have. And it helps us to realize we are far more than we think we are. We're more capable of doing things than we think we are. We can learn and move far more than we ever had an idea for. And that there is a force. You can call it a God. There is this incredible presence that guides all of this, and that we are a part of. And it just helps us all to broaden who and what we think we are and why we're here.
Yeah, well, you've had, as we said earlier, three near-death experiences within 3 months.
My own heavenly jammer effect.
Yes. And has it left you with an eagerness to get back to heaven?
No. It has left me with an eagerness to figure out what this world is and people are and why we do things the way we do. It's left me with an absolute desire, function, passion to learn more about why we think the way we do. Our brains are the way they are. And the way the world works and what we can do to help or hinder. It just left curiosity. So curious that now today I publish a free monthly newsletter. Anybody in the world can have it. Just get on my website, www.pmhatwater.com. That's all you need. Get over to the newsletter and sign up. There's an archive there. You can check past issues. And it's the newsletter of the curious. That's what I call it. Newsletter for the curious. I'm just so curious.
Well, 40 years of research. Yes, we can see that you're curious. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time now. We certainly could. Just very briefly, tell us about the next book and when it will be out.
I don't know when it's going to be out. I'm finishing chapter 12 today, and I get into chapter 13 later today. This book, my 19th one. Yeah, 19. Is the most personal I've ever written. And it's scary. It's scary because I'm talking about things that I've never talked about before. About my own life, my own childhood, but specifically about my research. Because I was told to do the research I do in my third near-death experience. I call the voice like none other.
We're going to have to leave this here on a cliffhanger.
Oh,
just what's the title of the new book?
I can't
what
tell
is
you
the
that.
You can't tell me that. Okay. So we're just going to have to remain curious.
Get the newsletter and then you'll find out all that's going on.
Yeah. It's always a delight to speak with you. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, Sandra. You betcha.
Okay. The Forever Angels, Near-Death Experiences in Childhood and Their Lifelong Impact is published by Bear & Company. For more information on the near-death phenomenon and PMH at Water's research and books, sign up for that newsletter at pmhatwater.com. And if you get a chance, read her book, Future Memory, one of my absolute favourite books of all time.
That's it for today.
That was the second book I was told to write by that voice.
I know, and it's a wonderful book. Okay, we have to leave it there, I'm afraid. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. I'll be back with another edition of What Is Going On at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, PMH.